All right, let's dive into a deep dive today. It's a case that really makes you think, Bayes v. Rees. It takes us into the world of the death penalty and constitutional law. We're talking about lethal injection, the Eighth Amendment, and what cruel and unusual punishment really means. You might be surprised at how this 2008 Supreme Court case is still shaping legal battles even today.
You know, what's fascinating about Bayes v. Rees is how it really set a precedent, a sort of legal roadmap, if you will, for handling future challenges to execution methods, especially those using lethal injection.
It's interesting how one case can just have this ripple effect across the legal landscape. To understand its significance, I think we need to go back to the beginning. This case started with two Kentucky death row inmates, Ralph Bayes and Thomas Bolling, both convicted of double homicides and both facing execution by lethal injection. What was it about the process that they objected to?
Well, at that time, Kentucky, like many other states, used a three-drug cocktail for lethal injections. First, sodium thiopental was used to render the inmate unconscious, then pancuronium bromide to paralyze the muscles, and finally, potassium chloride to stop the heart. Sounds pretty straightforward, but the second drug, that paralytic, that's where things get ethically murky.
Because, you know, if that first drug doesn't work properly, the person could be conscious and in agonizing pain, but completely unable to move or even cry out.
Yeah.
It's a chilling thought. No wonder Bayes and Bolling challenged Kentucky's protocol.
Exactly. Their core argument was that this method, this three-drug cocktail, created an unnecessary risk of cruel and unusual punishment, which is prohibited by the Eighth Amendment. They suggested a simpler single-drug protocol, using just a large dose of barbiturates, you know, believing it would be a faster and potentially less painful way to carry out the execution.
Their proposed solution seems pretty straightforward, but I know that the court didn't completely agree with them, so walk me through the court's decision.
Yeah, the court actually upheld Kentucky's three-drug protocol, but in doing so, they established a new standard for evaluating Eighth Amendment challenges to execution methods. And that was the substantial risk of serious harm standard.
Okay, that phrase, substantial risk of serious harm, sounds pretty significant. What are the real-world implications of that standard? How do we kind of unpack that legal jargon?
Sure. It essentially means the inmate has to demonstrate more than just a theoretical possibility of pain. They need hard evidence showing the method is highly likely to cause significant avoidable suffering. Think of it this way. The court wasn't demanding the safest method imaginable. Instead, they were demanding proof of a ticking time bomb, not just a hypothetical risk.
So it's a higher burden of proof for the inmate. They can't just claim something might be cruel. They need to prove it's almost guaranteed to be cruel. Is that right?
You got it. And they also need to present a practical alternative, a method that's demonstrably less likely to cause harm.
This brings us to the majority opinion in Bayes v. Rees. Who wrote it? And what were the key points of their reasoning?
Well, the plurality opinion, meaning it had the most agreement but not a full majority, was written by Chief Justice Roberts. He emphasized two main points. First, the need for objective evidence demonstrating that substantial risk of harm. And second, he placed the burden on the inmate to prove not only the risk, but also the viability of a better alternative. There's a powerful quote from his opinion. He wrote, "Simply because an execution method may result in pain does not establish an objectively intolerable risk of harm."
Wow, that's a pretty strong statement. It really underscores that this isn't about the mere possibility of pain, but about an objectively intolerable level of suffering. But the court wasn't unanimous in its decision, right? There were concurring and dissenting opinions as well.
Absolutely. And they offer valuable insights into the varying interpretations of the Eighth Amendment. For instance, Justices Scalia and Thomas took a more rigid stance.
This is where it gets really interesting because we start to see the fault lines within the court. How did their perspective differ from the plurality opinion?
Well, Scalia and Thomas argued that the Eighth Amendment only prohibits methods designed specifically to inflict pain. Their focus was on the intent behind the method, not necessarily the outcome. As long as the state wasn't deliberately trying to be cruel, they argued, it was constitutional.
That raises some tricky questions, doesn't it? How do you actually prove intent in these situations? But before we delve into that, I'm curious to hear about the other side of the argument. What about the dissenting opinions? Who disagreed with the plurality and on what grounds?
Well, Justices Ginsburg and Souter, they offered a really powerful dissent, expressing, you know, deep concern about the lack of safeguards in Kentucky's protocol compared to other states using lethal injection. They highlighted procedures like EEG monitoring, you know, which Kentucky didn't employ, as a crucial way to confirm unconsciousness and minimize the risk of a botched execution.
So it wasn't just about the drugs themselves, but about the processes in place to ensure those drugs were administered in a way that truly minimized suffering. It seems like Ginsberg and Souter were advocating for a more cautious and, dare I say, humane approach.
Precisely. Their dissent wasn't necessarily a condemnation of lethal injection as a whole, but rather a critique of Kentucky's, you know, specific approach and the potential for things to go terribly wrong.
And then there's Justice Stevens. His concurrence took a completely different path, didn't it? He used this case as a springboard to launch into a critique of the death penalty itself.
Stevens's concurrence is really fascinating because it tackles a much broader issue. He labels the death penalty as pointless and needless, even though the constitutionality of capital punishment wasn't the case's central question. He essentially argues that a punishment that serves no legitimate purpose could be considered inherently cruel and unusual.
That's a thought-provoking argument. It challenges us to consider whether a punishment can be cruel and unusual simply because it lacks a clear purpose. It seems like Stevens was looking beyond the technical details of execution methods and grappling with the fundamental morality of the death penalty itself.
Exactly. His concurrence raises questions that extend far beyond Bayes v. Rees. Is the death penalty about retribution? Deterrence? Or is it, as Stevens suggests, an outdated practice that no longer aligns with our evolving understanding of justice and human dignity? These are questions that continue to fuel legal and societal debates about capital punishment.
Okay, so we've got a fractured court, passionate opinions on both sides, and this new substantial risk of serious harm standard that's going to be debated and litigated for years to come. That's Bayes v. Rees in a nutshell. But the story doesn't end there, does it?
Yeah.
This case had a lasting impact on death penalty law in the U.S. Didn't it create a whole new wave of legal challenges?
You're absolutely right. Bayes v. Rees didn't settle the lethal injection debate. In fact, it opened the door for even more litigation, especially when states encountered a rather unexpected problem, drug shortages.
I remember reading about that. States suddenly couldn't obtain the drugs necessary for the three-drug protocol. What happened? Did they have to find a whole new execution method?
Well, sodium thiopental, the anesthetic used to render the inmate unconscious, became incredibly scarce. Some pharmaceutical companies stopped producing it altogether, and others refused to sell it for executions due to ethical concerns. This shortage forced states to adapt, and many turned to experimenting with different drugs, often with little scientific backing for their effectiveness as anesthetics.
That sounds incredibly risky. Weren't they concerned about botched executions?
It was a recipe for disaster. And unfortunately, there were several horrifying cases where inmates took much longer to die, exhibited visible signs of distress, and even appeared to regain consciousness during the execution. The situation became chaotic and ethically troubling.
And I'm assuming these issues ended up back in the Supreme Court.
You bet. One of the most significant cases to emerge from this situation was Glossop v. Gross in 2015. Inmates in Oklahoma challenged the state's use of midazolam, a sedative, as the first drug in their lethal injection protocol. They argued that midazolam wasn't a reliable anesthetic and that its use created a substantial risk of excruciating pain.
So they were essentially using the substantial risk of serious harm standard established in Bayes to argue against a modified version of the three-drug protocol. It's fascinating how legal precedents can be used to challenge seemingly similar situations. But did their argument succeed?
Not quite. The court, once again, upheld the state's execution method. Even though the evidence presented against midazolam was pretty damning, this decision led to a scathing dissent from Justice Sotomayor, who accused the majority of ignoring the very real and disturbing risks of a botched execution.
This raises an interesting question, doesn't it? How much evidence is enough to meet that Bayes standard? Did the court set the bar too high, or is this about respecting states' rights to carry out lawful executions?
It's a complex issue with no easy answers. Bayes v. Rees, despite setting this high bar for proving substantial risk, didn't result in the court intervening to prevent potentially cruel and unusual punishments, even in light of drug shortages and botched executions. This tension between protecting individual rights and respecting state autonomy lies at the heart of death penalty cases.
It sounds like a constant balancing act. On one hand, you have the Eighth Amendment's safeguard against cruel and unusual punishment, and on the other hand, you have the court's reluctance to interfere with states' rights to carry out legal executions.
It highlights the inherent complexity of these cases. The court seems to be saying, we trust that states won't be intentionally barbaric, but we're not going to micromanage how they choose to conduct executions. And this brings us back to Justices Scalia and Thomas, whose argument centered on intent rather than outcome.
It's amazing how one case can unveil such a vast array of legal and ethical considerations. So the drug shortages presented a significant obstacle for states trying to carry out executions. Did they lead to any long-term changes in how states approach lethal injection? Did any states switch to the single drug protocol that Bayes and Bolling initially proposed?
Ironically, the very solution that Bayes and Bolling proposed, you know, the single drug protocol, it actually became increasingly common, not because the court mandated it, but because of those practical constraints. It really demonstrates how real-world limitations can sometimes drive those legal and procedural changes more effectively than court rulings.
It's like an unintended consequence of the legal battle. So Bayes created this new standard. Drug shortages threw a wrench into the system, and states had to adapt. What's the overarching takeaway for lawyers and law students listening to this deep dive? What are the core lessons to be gleaned from Bayes v. Rees?
You know, I think the key takeaway is the sheer complexity of death penalty litigation. It's not just about interpreting those legal texts, you know, it's about navigating the intersection of law, science, medicine, and even societal values. Understanding evolving standards of decency plays a crucial role in determining what constitutes cruel and unusual punishment in a constantly changing world.
It's like what might have been deemed acceptable a century ago could be considered barbaric today.
Mm.
It makes you realize that the law is not static. It's constantly evolving.
Precisely. Bayes v. Rees exemplifies this tension between originalism, interpreting the Constitution based on its original meaning, and a more fluid understanding of rights that adapts to contemporary values.
So even though this case is over a decade old, it's still incredibly relevant. It offers a framework for understanding the legal complexities surrounding capital punishment. And it forces us to grapple with profound ethical questions about the purpose and justification of the death penalty in modern society.
Absolutely. And remember those concurring and dissenting opinions we discussed. They weren't just footnotes to the main decision. They represent the ongoing debate within the court and within society at large about how we approach the death penalty in the 21st century.
They really highlight the diversity of viewpoints on this incredibly sensitive and multifaceted issue.
Exactly. Take Justice Stevens' critique, for example. His argument that the death penalty might be inherently cruel and unusual simply because it's pointless and needless is a powerful one. It challenges us to think beyond the mechanics of execution and consider the fundamental purpose of punishment itself.
It raises the question, can a punishment be considered cruel and unusual if it serves no demonstrably useful purpose? If it's not about retribution or deterrence, then what is it about?
Precisely. And that question continues to resonate in legal circles and public discourse. Bayes v. Rees didn't give us easy answers, but it did illuminate these complex issues and push the conversation forward.
So where do things stand now? Is Bayes v. Rees the final word on lethal injection in the Eighth Amendment? Or is this an ongoing legal and societal saga?
Hardly the final word. As new execution methods emerge and as our societal values continue to shift, the legal battles over the Eighth Amendment and its application to capital punishment will undoubtedly continue. Bayes v. Rees was a pivotal chapter, but the story is far from over.
It seems like the only constant in this area of law is change.
And that's what makes it so fascinating. Bayes v. Rees provided a framework, a set of legal principles to grapple with, but the ongoing task of applying those principles, of defining cruel and unusual punishment in a world where technology and values are constantly in flux, that remains a dynamic process.
So for our listeners out there, whether you're a seasoned lawyer or a law student just starting your journey, Bayes v. Rees is a case worth revisiting. It offers a glimpse into the intricate world of death penalty litigation and compels us to confront uncomfortable questions about the very nature of justice.
And it serves as a potent reminder that the law is not a fixed entity, but a living, evolving system that reflects the values and complexities of our society. As new challenges arise, we must continually reevaluate our understanding of fundamental rights and ensure that the justice system aligns with our evolving concept of human dignity.
Beautifully said. And on that note, we'll leave you with a final thought to ponder. If, as Justice Stevens argued, the death penalty truly serves no purpose, does that automatically render it cruel and unusual? Is there room in a just society for a punishment that claims no practical aim? This is a question for you to wrestle with, your listeners. Until next time, keep diving deep.